The following lecture was delivered at the 17th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Palm Desert, California, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Mrs. Razi Chechik now presents her lecture, Reaching Toward the Infinite, Healthy, Resilient, and Spiritual Families.
Okay, good afternoon. It's an absolute pleasure. My name is Razi Chechik, and it's an absolute pleasure to have the opportunity to learn together with you today, particularly on a topic that is so close to my heart, that is healthy, resilient, and spiritual families. And I would say what I am particularly interested in is the nexus of spirituality and mental health. And what I'd love to do before we begin today is sort of introduce with a visual and a text that I think speaks very meaningfully to our topic. So this is a text I came across several years ago, written in the 12th century by a scholar, Eleazar of Worms, known eponymously as the Rokeach, after his classic work in which he offers commentaries on the Chumash and a beautiful expression of customs of life in early medieval Ashkenaz. And as depicted in this painting from the Machzor of Worms in the 12th century, he describes this ritual that when a child in the 12th century was deemed ready for beginning Torah study, his parents would wake the child up early in the morning on Shavuot, right, paralleling the holiday of Matan Torah, and wrap the child in a cloak or a talis, a talit, and bring him through the early morning street to the home of the rabbi or teacher, and place him on the lap of the rabbi in his literal and figurative embrace. And the rabbi would take out a tablet on which it was written, Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, the Aleph, Bet, and he would recite the letters on each letter, and the child would recite the letters after him and lick the honey off the letters. And then he would take out a second tablet on which were written canonical psukim, like Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe, and Torah Tehe Emunati. And again, he would recite the letters and put honey on the letters. And the child would repeat the psukim and lick the honey off the letters. And then the child would step off the rabbi's lap and be approached by the other young children from the community who would offer him little cakes with Torah phrases sort of iced on top. And together, the children and the rabbi and the parents would walk down to the nearest river or stream. And the rabbi would point to the water and say, so should your connection to Torah be, everlasting, flowing, and eternal. And this custom faded in practice in Ashkenaz in about the 15th century. It was revived in the last century. I believe many in the Chabad movement practice it. And Professor Ivan Marcus of Yale University actually says that the custom we have of dipping an apple in honey on Rosh Hashanah at the start of the school year emerges from this particular custom. But the ethos of this custom, I think, are as strong today as they were a millennia ago when it was popularly practiced. The idea of cultivating spirituality as being a partnership of family and community, the idea of connection to God and Torah being something sweet, and the idea that spirituality and Torah study are lifelong and eternal. And if our rabbis a millennia ago in a deeply spiritual world paid focus, right, to how we cultivate spirituality, I think how much more so this mandate is upon us in a world that is decidedly different. And that is really our topic today. And what I'd like to do to sort of frame this vast topic in a manageable way is give it three overarching questions. Number one, why is it important to cultivate spirituality in children? Number two, what holds us back from effectively doing so? And number three, what are some practical techniques and suggestions as to how we can cultivate this spirituality in children? Right, children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, the children of our communities and the children we love in our lives. So what I'd love to do is begin our conversation today, not from a place of the theological imperative, it's so suited that we have a child crying in the background, but from what the research tells us about children and spirituality, what we know from the academy, as it were, about children and spirituality. And the doyenne of research on children and spirituality is a woman named Lisa Miller, who I believe was a guest here last year, speaking about another topic. She is the founder of the Mind, Body, Spirit Institute at Columbia University Teachers College, a professor of psychology, and the author of a book called The Spiritual Child that I highly recommend. And when she published that book in about 2016, she writes how she began her research on children and spirituality. There was pushback in the academy that spirituality isn't a real science. And there wasn't even an agreed-upon definition for what spirituality is. So she wrote one, and I love it, and I'm happy to use it for the purposes of our conversation today. Spirituality is an inner sense of a living relationship to a higher power that is loving and guiding. Spirituality is an inner sense of a living relationship to a higher power that is loving and guiding. And one of the most striking things about her research, we're going to discuss 3 points from the research. One of the most striking things from her research is that children are born with an almost fully developed capacity for spiritual connection. Right? Their expressive and receptive language skills are months and years off. Their faculties for mobility are months and years off. But they are born with this capacity and almost innate understanding that there is something outside of them that is loving and guiding. If you take a tiny baby and you place it on its mother's abdomen, right, a neonate, it will know to root upward for warmth and for nourishment, that children are born with this awareness of something outside of them that is loving and guiding. There was a philosopher and theologian at Oxford University named Justin Barrett, who wrote a powerful book as well called Born Believers, How Children's Brains Are Hardwired for Belief. And in what's considered the holy grail of scientific research, the twin study, there was a professor, Kenneth Kendler, who specializes in the nexus of genetics and psychiatry, who did a study on over 2,000 twins, finding genetic correlate for a sense of personal connection to the transcendent. So point number one from the research, as we approach these questions, is that children are born with a powerful, inherent spiritual sense. The second point, very important, and these are increasing in hierarchical importance, but so this one is such a powerful one, that there are incredible benefits to children in almost every area of their functioning when this spirituality is cultivated. And there are so many different statistics. I'm going to cite 3. When we cultivate spirituality in children, they are 40% less likely to engage in alcohol or substance abuse as adolescents or young adults. They are 60% less likely to experience the scourge of depression and anxiety as adolescents and young adults. And anyone who has lived with or worked with young adults in the past decade is aware that the rates of depression and anxiety since 2012 are actually unprecedented in young people. There was an article in The Atlantic in 2017 by a researcher, Jean Twenge. It had a very provocative title, Have Smartphones Destroyed a Generation? And she's a researcher of generational shifts, and she said normally they sort of look like this. In 2012, we started seeing spikes, and she correlates it as 2012 being the year that more than 50% of Americans had smartphones and the impact that had on children's psychosocial development. So children whose spiritual hub is cultivated are 40% less likely, as I said, to engage in substance abuse, 60% less likely to experience depression and anxiety as adolescents and young adults, and 80% less likely to engage in unsafe practices in their personal relationships. And there are correlates in almost every area of life, their sense of self, their sense of identity, relationships, even in the academic and professional space, benefits to children when this spirituality is cultivated. There's actually some fascinating correlate evidence as well that when adults cultivate this spirituality in children, there is a mirror benefit to the adults who are doing that that cultivation. So point number one, children are born with inherent spirituality. Point number two, there are tremendous psychological and cognitive and social benefits to children when this spirituality is thus developed. And just the tremendous benefit to them in every single area of their lives. And a third point that she raises in her research, and again, supported by the rest of the research, and I would say if you remember nothing else that I say today, remember this one point. What is the single greatest thing that we can do to cultivate spirituality in children? Are you with me for most important point? The single most important thing that we can do is to talk about God in the here and in the now. So not just God of the past and the Chumash and the Navi and God of the Sidur, but to talk about God in the here and in the now. So statements like, when I light candles every week, when I bench lecht, I ask Hashem to give you a good week ahead. When Aunt Cecilia is in the hospital, right, I pray that God gives her a refuah shleima. When you're traveling in a beautiful place, look at these magnificent mountains. What a wonderful world God has created. That the research is unequivocal, that talking about God in the here and the now is the single greatest thing that we can do to cultivate spirituality in children and give them these enormous benefits in every developmental stage of their life. And here I revert from the research for a moment to Jewish sources that I think very much align, right? When we think of our lives as Jews, we experience time in the solar arc of the day and in the lunar arc of the year, right? In the solar arc of the day, an epicentral spiritual moment is the recitation of Shema. Think of the text of Shema and how it discusses transmission of legacy. V'shinantam levanecha, you should teach it these words to your children. V'tzibartabam, and you should speak to them. When? It doesn't say b'makom asher yivchar, right, in the Bet HaMikdash, in the equivalent of a synagogue or a study hall. It says b'shiftecha b'veitecha, when you're sitting around the dinner table. V'lechtecha baderach, when you're on a family trip. B'shachvecha, in those quiet, magical moments of bath time and bedtime when children are full of questions. B'kumecha, in those halcyon moments of the morning before the bustle of the day. That talking about God in the here and the now is very aligned with the Jewish texts and sources. When we think about how we experience time in the lunar arc, the arc of the year, what is an epicentral intergenerational moment in the lunar arc of the year? One could posit it's the Seder, right? When we sit down with generations and we tell our story. And think of the text of the Seder. The text of the Haggadah speaks about our relaying of legacy. V'higadta levincha b'yom ha'hu lemar. You should tell your child on that day saying, Ba'avur zeh asa Hashem li b'tzeiti mimitzrayim. Right, this is what God did for me when I left Egypt. The idea of talking about God in the here and the now is extremely powerful for transmission of legacy. So question number one, why should we work to cultivate a spiritual landscape or relationship with God and children? In addition to the theological imperative, the tremendous psychological benefits to children when we do so. And we'll move ahead to question number two. If it's so important to cultivate a spiritual landscape in children, what holds us back from effectively doing so? And there was an interesting Barna research poll. It's a research organization that studies spirituality in American life. Thousands of American parents were called and asked the following set of questions. Question number one, do you think it is your job to teach your children about God? 85% of American parents answered yes, which is showing interesting shifts in American society. But 85% of American parents answered yes. The second question was, how many of you have spoken to your children about God in the past week? Anyone want to guess what the percentage went down to? It went down to less, just under 20%. And the assumption is that people are exaggerating with positive answers. So that's like a very sharp gap. Why is it that we are so hesitant to speak to our children, our grandchildren, the children in our lives about God? I just want to point out, if anyone in this audience is a grandparent, that all of the research that I cited of the benefits of spirituality are enhanced by an inherent 20% when it's intergenerational, right? So this applies on a multi-generational level. So why is it that we are hesitant to speak to our children, our grandchildren, the children in our lives about God? We're not hesitant to speak about morals and values, right? Be honest, be kind, act with integrity. Most of us also aren't hesitant to speak to children about the rituals as we perform them in our families, right? If we keep kosher, or we wear a kippah, or we dress in a certain way, we're not hesitant to speak about that. So why is it that we don't talk about God? And I'd like to posit that most of us as adults, we have challenges in our relationship with God. And we have questions, and we have some moments of discomfort. And because of that, we're hesitant to talk about God, and we shut the conversation down in ways that are detrimental to our children, our grandchildren, the children in our lives, and to ourselves. And that it's okay when a child comes to you with a question to acknowledge and answer and honor the question, and even to say, I also sometimes have questions. Sometimes that's the most powerful modeling that we can do for a child. And I don't think we should invoke questions in children. We don't need to walk over to a five-year-old and say, have you heard about Kierkegaard's teleological suspension of the ethical and the fear and the trembling? But when children come to us with questions, to honor that questions are part of the journey. And I'm going to give here an anecdotal study that I did in Manhattan Day School as I was learning through some of this research. I decided to go into every classroom, starting with kindergarten, all the way through middle school, and ask them about their perception of God. I'm just going to share with you three of the anecdotes. I walked into kindergarten. It was Elul. They had just come back from an apple-picking trip before Rosh Hashanah. I sat down on the carpet with the six-year-olds, and I said to them, tell me about Hashem. And this little girl raises her hand, and she says, Hashem is the one who puts the apples on all of the trees. And also, Ms. Chechik, I really like your earrings. And I say that because to her, those were on the exact same linear plane of reality. Then I walked into a first grade class where they were preparing for their Siddur presentation. And I said to them, there are children who don't go to Jewish schools and don't know about Hashem and don't have this benefit of tefillah and having a siddur. What would you tell them? Who is Hashem? And I remember this little redheaded boy looked up at me with a combination of pity and contempt in his eyes. Like, I can't believe they hired this woman to run our school and she doesn't know the answer to this basic question. And he said to me, like, Ms. Chechik, God is the creator of all living things. And then he went back to his coloring, like, I'm glad I cleared that up for her. But by the time I got to the eighth grade classroom, the answers got more complex. I walked into an eighth grade girl's classroom, and I said, tell me about God. And I was generally not a God talker. And they looked at me as if a small bomb had dropped in the classroom. And they looked at each other. I've actually never seen them quite that quiet. It was total silence. And one brave, intrepid young woman raised her hand, and she said, is it okay to say that I struggle in my relationship with Hashem, and there are times I daven and feel connection, but often I don't, and I have moments of closeness, but often I feel distance. And I looked around the room, and there was such a relief on all of the other students' faces, thanking her silently for articulating what they were thinking. And here is what I responded, and I think this is such an important model of a response. I said, of course it's okay to have doubt. The opposite of faith is not doubt. The opposite of faith is certainty. And it's a beautiful truism, right? That faith implies a choice to believe and struggles and questions. And I told them the three following brief anecdotes. One was from a Baal Musar, an ethicist of the prior generation, Rav Shlomo Volba, who always said, there is no such thing as a heretical question. And I told them a beautiful citation from Rav Avraham Yitzchak Kook, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who dealt so much with the secular and socialist olim to the land of Israel between 1902 and 1914, seeing the holiness in them. And he said, a struggling soul, a questioning soul, is the sign of a soul that's alive. Something dead is flatlined. Something alive is moving and questioning. And the final anecdote I told them was something I heard from a student of Rav Lichtenstein from Yeshivat Har Etzion, the former Rosh Yeshiva, Gam Zichrono Levracha, who told his students 1 year before Yom Kippur, I daven 3 times a day, I pray 3 times a day, in the hope that once a year I will feel a connection to the divine. This was their Rosh Yeshiva. And once I sort of opened up this permission for struggle, it was like opening up the floodgates among these young adolescents. And they revealed this beautiful, deep spiritual landscape that I would not have expected in this like coolest group of students. One of them raised her hand, and she shared her mother was a Gioret Tzedek, a righteous convert from Jamaica. And she said, I hadn't seen my grandmother from Jamaica in 12 years since I was a tiny little girl. And she came to visit us last year. She landed at the airport, and I was waiting with my mom and my baby brother. And she came to the airport, and she took us all in this embrace. And I felt her love, and I felt God's love. And another young woman raised her hand, and she spoke about her grandmother as well, who lived in England and had been in ill health for much of her adult life and never been able to visit Israel. And her dream had been to go to the Kotel HaMaravi, to the Kotel, and she never made it. She said, after my grandmother passed away, last summer our family took a trip to Israel. I took a stone from her grave, I brought it to the Kotel, I placed it in the wall, and I felt my grandmother's presence, and I felt God's presence. Right? Notice that two of these stories relate to grandparents. And the third was a young woman who raised her hand, and she said, last summer in camp, we took a hike, a sunrise hike. And at the top of the mountain, I looked out as the sun rose, like glowing over the, you know, ruffling waters. And in the beauty of nature, I felt God's presence, right? Which is also very common for young people and adults, that in the beauty of nature and the quiet, feeling God's presence. So by giving them this permission to struggle, it opens up this deep sense of relationship. So question number one, just to review, why should we work to cultivate a spiritual landscape in children? In addition to the theological imperative, the tremendous psychological benefits that we discussed in all realms of life when spirituality is cultivated. Question number two, what holds us back from effectively doing so? We mentioned the Barna research poll, but this is not unique to Jewish Americans. And I think it's often our own struggles that hold us back, but they should not, when appropriate, we should make them part of the conversation. And our final question, and then I welcome any questions from you. What are practical techniques or suggestions to meaningfully cultivate this spiritual landscape? And I'm going to ask you a question and then move ahead with 3 more suggestions. Do you remember what the research told us is the single greatest thing we can do to cultivate spirituality in children? Let me know I did a good job. Yep. Talking about God in the here and the now, right? So the greatest, all of the research coalesces around this idea that the single greatest thing we could do is talk about God in the here and the now. With that, I'm going to give 3 other suggestions, and I'm also going to give you a mnemonic device to try to remember them. Some of the research that I cited that was about grandparents was commissioned by an organization called the Jewish Grandparents Network, JGN. So that's going to be our mnemonic device, JGN, Jewish Grandparents Network. And the 3 ideas that I'd like to talk about, the 3 suggestions, are joy, giving, and narrative. JGN, joy, giving, and narrative. Much of neuroscience, buttresses and supports the idea that what embeds in memory are things that are encircled by great emotion, right? So you might not remember where you put your keys in the morning, but you might remember your 3rd birthday party or a funeral of a loved one. If we want our children to hold on to legacy, our children, our grandchildren, the children of our community to hold on to legacy, it is powerfully important to encircle our traditions with joy. Right? Rav Moshe Feinstein famously said in the 60s, when it looked like Orthodoxy in America was going to die, he said, we are losing a generation because parents come home and they say to their children, excuse my Yiddish, it's schwer to sein a Yid. it's hard to be a Jew. I worked with a wonderful colleague at the Hebrew Academy of Long Beach, Rabbi Yisrael Kamenetsky, who would always tell his high school students, it's geschmack to be a Yid. It is joyous to be a Jew. And to the extent that we could bring that joy to practice with the children in our lives, we are guaranteeing insurance of legacy, of development of spirituality, and insurance of legacy. And I'm going to share two anecdotes, one from my own life and one from my professional life. I had three children in 4 years, so when my children were small and I was working full-time as an assistant principal, I would come home Friday afternoon to like a five-year-old, a four-year-old, a three-year-old. You can imagine that Friday afternoons were not the most peaceful time, as I was rushing to make sure, maybe this is just me, but in our household, it was not the most peaceful time. And I remember speaking to another veteran mother, a woman who I really respected. I said, give me your one key parenting tip. Your spiritual parenting tip. She said, make the moment Shabbat comes in the happiest moment in your household. My children at the time loved this Israeli chocolate called Click. I believe you had some with you at lunch today at our table. So I started purchasing these little bags of chocolate, and every week, no matter how busy Friday was, when the time came for Hadlakat Neirot, for benching Lecht, we would sit down, I would give the children these bags of chocolate, we would sit together, and it was truly a highlight of the week, right? That special halcyon time. My son today is married, living in Jerusalem with two babies of his own. When I go visit him for Shabbos or when he comes here, I bring those bags of chocolate, I still give them to him, his face lights up, right? He's still a parent, for what it evokes as to what Shabbos means, right? Encircling it with joy. The other example relates to a parent in one of the schools I worked in, very, very minimally observant religiously, and all of his children are actually beautifully religious, having raised very observant homes. And I remember sitting with him once at parent-teacher conferences, and he said, I had a terrible divorce. I have a complicated relationship with God. I'm not sure what I believe. I'm not even sure what I always practice, but I make Shabbos and holidays the happiest times for my children in our home. And all of the neighborhood children come, and, you know, Shavuos, we have a sushi chef come, and every holiday we have traditions because I want my children to feel joy in our households. But by making the joy around religious traditions, that joy was something his children associated with tradition and really held on to. So we have our three joy. Do you remember what the next one is? Giving, right? And then narrative. So the next one is giving. The same way that children are born with an inherent sense of spirituality, right? An inner sense of a living connection to a higher power that is loving and guiding. The same way that children are born with an inherent spirituality, part of that is they are born with an inherent empathy and capacity to care for others. You know the famous midrash about how the Egyptians, when they were seeking out Jewish babies, would bring an Egyptian baby into the home and make that baby cry? Because when one baby cries, another baby cries out of empathy. In Dr. Miller's book, she tells a story of a newspaper article that appeared during her research for a newspaper in the Midwest of these two twins, Brielle and Daphne, who were neonates, born very early, and both were in incubators. They were, I think, 2 months early. And at one point, Brielle was undergoing like cardiac distress. And the nurse intuitively took Daphne, the other twin, and put her in the incubator next to her sister, Brielle. And Daphne put her arm, this neonate baby, like intuitively put her arm over her sister, and the heart rate eased, right? Children are born with this capacity. If you've watched a classroom of pre-verbal two-year-olds, if one starts to cry, another will come over with a block or a toy trying to comfort them. I think when we recognize this in our children and grandchildren and the children in our lives, verbally we acknowledge this as their Tzelem Elokim. This is your divine spark. You are created in the image of God, right? This is your godly behavior. And that you're recognizing and honoring the Tzelem Elokim, the image of God in another. It is another beautiful way to honor, recognize, and cultivate spirituality in children. And even when the youngest children see lack in the world, you know, I lived for a long time in New York City. Sometimes you pass homeless people on the street, so young children are aware that others don't have. You could have young children help bring socks to the homeless, bring food to a food bank, buy fruit and leave it next to someone who's on a sidewalk. As with the Kierkegaard example, I don't think we should point out pain in the world to children, but when they come to us with that awareness, we can respond with what can we do to make it better and acknowledge that as part of the divinity within them. I was speaking to a grandparent who was a woman of means, and she told me that she had a bank account for each of her grandchildren. And along with the bank account, she had a giving account. And each time she would buy them a birthday present, she would say, what charity would you like us to give this amount to? You know, people who are hungry, people who are needy, a war zone, whatever they'd be aware of, so that, like, developing this sense of giving developmentally, for them. So we have joy, right, trying to encircle spiritual experiences with joy. And we can start this at any age or any stage. Giving, recognizing giving as being part of the divinity, enhancing that giving and acknowledging that giving as part of their divine spark. The last technique that I would suggest for cultivating spirituality in children, to give them all of the mental health benefits we discussed in question one, is the power of narrative and storytelling. And because of the brevity of our session, I'm not going to go into this in great depth, but there's a researcher named Marshall Duke of Emory University, and I have outlines of all of these sources that you're welcome to take after the session today, who speaks about the power of telling your family stories to your children, that I cannot overstate the significance and the benefits for mental health and resilience when children know their family stories, even the painful parts, and sometimes especially the painful parts of their family stories, to know that they have like modeling and almost genetic coding for overcoming hardship. So I'm going to give you, a personal anecdote from my own experience. I mentioned to you how children's spirituality kind of becomes more complex as they get older. If you walk into a K-12 school and you walk into the early childhood division, the children are belting out prayers with gusto. Right? And this goes on through third or fourth grade. By fourth grade for boys and fifth grade for girls, it starts to dip. And tefillah, davening in most centrist Orthodox schools, by the time you get to middle school or high school or in community schools, is really a struggle. So I walked into a classroom of fifth grade boys who were really struggling with tefillah. And I said to them, boys, what makes tefillah better for you? And they said, when Rebbe tells us a story in the morning before davening, right? The Rebbe was out that day, hence I was in with the fifth graders. So I did the following. I just heard this beautiful story from someone named Yoel Gold, and I tell you his name because he is, I think, the equivalent of a modern-day Magid. He gathers stories, he authenticates the stories, and then he shares the stories on social media. So I just heard this beautiful story that he had told, so therefore I trust it. There's a restaurant in Herzliya. There was a gentleman from America visiting this restaurant a few years back, and his server comes over, the waitress, and she says, hi, my name is Orna, and I will be helping you this evening. I don't know if any of you remember, but in 2014, when our boys, three boys were kidnapped and our young soldiers in Israel marched into Gaza, there was a hotline that you could call. I did this and all of my students did this, and you could get the name, the Hebrew name of an Israeli soldier, and you could pray for that soldier. So this man had been praying for a soldier whose name was Barak ben Orna. The server comes back with their first course and he says, I have a funny question for you. Do you perhaps have a son named Barak? She stopped. She said, I do. He said, is he like in his early 20s now? And she said, yes. And the man's eyes, she said, and the man said, did he fight in Tzuk Eitan? Was he in Gaza? And now her eyes start to well up, and she said, he was, thank God, he's home, he's safe, he's married, he has children. And the man starts to cry, and he says, I want you to know that I prayed for your son every single day of that war, that he should come home safely, right? And she starts to cry. I'm tearing up a little telling you the story. That day, those fifth grade boys, tefillah was silent, right? Silent and powerful. So it's hard to understate the power of thinking of stories that align with your values, seeking them from your own family, from other sources, and sharing them as a way to further spirituality in children. So by way of wrapping, or again, why is it important to cultivate a spiritual landscape in children? In addition to the theological imperative, the tremendous psychological benefits in every area of life. What holds us back from doing so? Perhaps our own doubts and hesitations, and they should not. It is perfectly appropriate and perhaps even laudatory to acknowledge if we struggle and honor and model that we work through struggle. That's part of faith. And remember the line, the opposite of faith is not doubt. The opposite of faith is certitude. And in conclusion, the practical techniques, I'm going to ask you for this. The first one, the biggest one from question one, what was first technique? Talking about in the here and the now, right? God in the here and now. And the mnemonic device of Jewish Grandparents Network. What are the three, everyone? You are the best group. Thank you for coming. I will close just with one beautiful thought from Mishnah in Pirkei Avot that in my old age I understand very differently from when I originally read it. In the third chapter of Pirkei Avot, there is a citation from Elisha ben Avuya. He is also known as Acher. He was a Talmudic sage who left the path and lived a very non-observant life. And throughout Talmudic literature, he is referred to as Acher, the other. But I think this is the only instance in which he is referred to by name. Amar Elisha ben Avuya. Elisha ben Avuya says, Halomed katan, what we learn as a young child, kidyo al niyar chadash, it is like ink on new parchment. In the ancient world, when parchment was expensive, made from calfskin or sheepskin or goatskin, we would write on the parchment, and if it wasn't a sacred text, if it was like a shopping list, we would use a stone to erase and then use it again. So what we learn as a young child is like etchings on fresh parchment, that no matter what's written subsequently, those etchings still come forward. Halomed zaken, what we learn as an old person, an older person, kidyo al niyar machuk. It is like ink etched into parchment that has already been used. When I originally learned this Mishnah, I thought that it meant if we don't learn something when we're young, you know, we never have that freshness. But what I realized the Mishnah is telling us is that at any point in life, we have the ability, like lidyo, to make inscriptions on our hearts. And I think perhaps there's a reason that Elisha ben Avuya is reminded of this, whoever edited that part of the Mishnah and left his name in, right, that there's always the capacity to learn new and to grow and to return. So thank you for listening. Really a pleasure to learn together with you. And if you have any questions, I welcome the opportunity.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.